Accession number 15110, Reel 2.
Mr. Thomas, Reel 2.
We then got out and managed to extract the old people who unfortunately were both dead. And there was another thing. Anyway, we had to get back into barracks then, where we were accommodated on board the old Marshal Ney, an old monitor, where we lived and slept and fed in barracks.
What had killed those two landlords?
Oh, the bomb. Oh, the collapsing of the house.
They'd been crushed, had they?
Oh, yeah. They were both dead.
And the bombing in the barracks that drove you out in the first place? What
that hit the accommodation block, the Boscawen block, was the chief and petty officer's accommodation block. And they hit the end part of that block. And I don't know how many casualties there were. There were quite a few injured. How many killed, I don't know. But anyway...
Was that just as frightening?
Not really, no. Because I wasn't submerged in that. And I just got out and down into the basements where we left. There were no underground shelters in Devonport at that time, in the barracks. Now, they were in Chatham. Chatham was honeycombed with tunnels underneath the barracks. Old tunnels, what they were for, I don't know really, but the tunnels were used like underground tunnels underneath Chatham barracks. Devonport didn't have those.
You said you went into the Marshal Ney?
Yes, an old monitor, which is part of the school. And we had our classrooms on there. And we slept in the classrooms.
How safe did you feel there?
The Plymouth bombing lasted about 2 weeks. The intensive bombing of Plymouth was over 2 weeks. And after that, things seemed to level out.
What was morale like in Plymouth under the bombings?
Well, they were shocked, of course. But it covered a wide area. Plymouth itself, the city itself, had was severely damaged. Devonport was very badly damaged. And the whole of the centre of Plymouth was virtually flattened. Little odd places standing out. But, no, I think that the opinion was, well, if they can take it in London, we can take it in Plymouth, sort of thing.
Did people flee into the countryside?
There were a lot evacuated. Youngsters were evacuated, yes. And those with families. See, Plymouth, the population of Plymouth has a lot of ex-service connections who came in, and the dockyard connections who came in from various other parts of the country into the dockyard, and a lot of those had relatives or such down in Cornwall and back in Wales and all around the countryside. I don't think there was any general evacuation as in London at all, but a lot of people did move out.
Did people go out just for the night?
I've lived so at that time. I haven't any personal recollection of that at all. Yeah, people did, if they had places to go to, did go out into the country.
So you were in the Marshal Ney, if you can take it on from there, please.
Yes. And we eventually finished our course. The latter part of the course was mainly involved in working on small ships like trawlers, drifters, minesweepers and tugs in the dockyard under our instructors. So we did practical work to get these ships refitted and turned round. And eventually, course finished, and after all that, I managed a first-class pass, which allowed me, which gave me 12 months advancement. I was made a recognition first class in 6 months, which was chief petty officer rate. And contrary to expectations, I rejoined Rodney. But it wasn't usual for to rejoin your ship after the mechanician's course. You usually went to another ship. But I rejoined Rodney in Birkenhead in February 1942. She was in there for some hull repairs and got in some 16-inch gun barrels chains.
What state was Birkenhead in after the bombing?
Well, it had been bombed, but I can't recall if the main bombing of Liverpool had taken place at that time. I can't remember.
I think 41. I think it had been earlier in 41 when
yes.
Merseyside was bombed.
Yes. But I say we didn't spend much time ashore. We just got ashore and in Rock Ferry or in Birkenhead. And when we went over to Gladstone Dock for docking, went ashore and into Liverpool then. And of course it was all blackout, you couldn't see anything anyway. And we had our various pubs and all we went to, our various haunts. And struck mainly down to the Seaforth end, Bootle end. And we used to go out towards Seaforth, from Seaforth to Blundell Sands Way. We didn't come into Liverpool when we went ashore a couple of hours in the evening.
Had Rodney changed much?
During the time I'd left her, she was of course engaged in the major magnus opus of the war that was sinking of Bismarck. And following the sinking of Bismarck, she went on to Boston then. She was on her way to Boston for a refit when she was escorting the Majestic across to Halifax. And was diverted then to engage Bismarck. And she had on board all her spare parts and bits and pieces she needed for repairs in Boston. She also had about 50 merchant navy officers on board who were going over to take over ships in the United States. She also had 50 observer, Fleet Air Observer candidates taking passage out to Bermuda for training. And they're all involved in the action. And of course she came back to Greenock then after the Bismarck action and then went back to Boston for refit. Well, she spent 11 weeks in Boston. And of course I learned all that second hand. And it was the main topic of conversation for at least a year afterwards. So I can go through the Bismarck action with you, blow by blow. And all the hijinks in Boston, virtually, by having it recounted ad nauseum in the mess. Yeah. Yes, apparently they had a whale of a time in Boston. Although they did have one set to the American Marines, who claimed that there's certain hostelry in Scully Square in Boston was their headquarters, and warned our sailors not to go in there. Anyway, that was like a magnet to our blokes. At that time, we had some very, very taut hands on board, with the naval heavyweight boxing champion on board and the navy middleweight champion boxer on board. So they went to this place in Boston, and one picture of which is recalled to me was. This large person called Lofty Webber, who was a heavyweight boxer, stood on the stage with a big drum fitted around his ankles. And they sorted the American Marines out anyway. So we upheld the reputation of the Royal Navy in Boston at that time.
How long were you in Birkenhead for?
At that time, about 5 weeks, I think. About a month, 5 weeks, then we went over for docking then. And then we went from there up to Loch Horrible, I think it was.
Loch Horrible?
Loch Horrible, up in the Western Isles. where we were on a very secretive mission there. Went up there and we moored there, and were surrounded by anti-submarine nets and various things going on, of which we were not told anything at all. And apparently it was a dress rehearsal for the midget submarine attack on Tirpitz. We were netted in there with all the defences which ostensibly were around Tirpitz, and although we were told nothing of this at all at the time. But when things came out years afterwards, that it seemed as if that was the object of the exercise.
Is this a nickname, Loch Horrible, or is it true name?
Loch Horrible, no. Horrible. Not horrible, horrible, I think. It's up in up near Loch Hugh. We thought we were going to Loch Hugh, but it wasn't Loch Hugh, it was Loch Horrible. Anyway, you can say it was a Scottish loch. you can check the map just to see if it is a map's name for it, or if it's the actual name for it, or if it is a code name for it. I don't know. But we were told it was Loch Horrible. Whether that's true or not, I can't vouch for. But we were there, and then we started then escorting convoys down to Freetown to reinforce Montgomery's troops in North Africa. They were sailing around the Cape, of course, and we used to stage them down to Freetown, where we had a wait there for watering and fueling and whatnot. And then steamed them south and turned over to the Simonstown-based squadron. Came back to Freetown then. And we worked off Freetown for a while. Yeah.
Did you run into the enemy on any of those convoys?
No. We had no active engagements. Submarines were active in the West African areas, you know. Very active there.
I think that you're in the North Africa landings.
Yes.
Operation Pedestal.
Yes.
This is November.
No, Operation Pedestal was the was the Malta convoy. Operation Pedestal was Malta.
Was that before the
before North Africa landings?
North Africa landings.
Yeah, we were actually
the North Africa landings was Torch, yes.
Torch. We were escorting convoys down to Freetown, and we were continuing to, on the last convoy we did to Freetown, we were destined to join the Eastern Fleet. And we were steaming south, farther south than we usually went, and we were all excited because we were looking forward to a run ashore in Cape Town. And a lot of us went back and drew some money out for a run ashore in Cape Town. But unfortunately, just off Walvis Bay, I think it was, Shropshire and the other squadron took over from us, and we turned north again. Eventually, to make up Nelson Rodney, this was, Operation Pedestal. Nelson Rodney was selected to cover Operation Pedestal as the battleships to prevent intervention from the Italian fleet, which is very big then and very active in its own waters, of course. And also for our very heavy anti-aircraft cover fire. We were very well covered for anti-aircraft weapons. We had a lot of additions and all made as the war progressed. We had, I think, we had 6 4.7 ACAC. We had multiple pom-poms. We had Ehrlichans. We had 107 Ehrlichans. And we had 8-barreled and 4-barreled pom-poms. And we split up a very formidable barrage. And to cap it all, we're the only ships ever to use 16-inch guns as anti-aircraft weapons. We loaded the center guns of each turret, loaded with these special shells, special contact fuses, or proximity fuses, whatever they call them. they were adapted from our aircraft fuses to fit the 16-inch shells. And during one attack by, I think it was 27 Italian torpedo bombers coming in, Rodney opened fire at about 9 miles with a 16-inch and frightened us, our escorts, and the Italians, so they disappeared. Whether they were shot down, but they didn't press on the attack. And people were around us thought that we'd been hit. And no one expected to see 16-inch guns fired. And when a 16-inch gun is fired, there's a hell of a noise, and a hell of a shock, and a hell of a cloud of smoke, just as if you'd been hit. Of course, you don't hear a 16-inch gun fired when you're down below in the engine room. Just feel it. Old ship move. The ACAC guns used to being on top of the vents to the, and by the funnel. You'd make a hell of a crack, hell of a noise down the ballrooms and engine room. It was a 16-inch gun you didn't hear. So anyway, that is... we had a few near misses and eventually got back to Gibraltar. We had border trouble, which is recurring all through our life. She always had border trouble because Rodney was built under the limitation of armaments under the Washington Treaty. And she had a lot of cost-bearing to meet the capital cost and, of course, weight-bearing. So we had... That's why she was shaped as she was. Rodney Nelson had all the main armament forward in one battery. So there's one armored citadel, which got down the weight. And people all presumed that they ran out of money when they were being built, so they didn't finish them. That was one opinion. And she was designed that way to meet the 35,000 tons limitation. To meet that, and using 16-inch guns, they had to concentrate the main armor and armament in one citadel. And rising from the cost bearing, our boilers were originally built as saturated steam boilers and adapted for superheaters. They had generating tubes blanked off and superheaters inserted, which was always a source of trouble. Compromise is never the best thing. So that we always had boiler trouble. We always had leaking superheater tubes. It happened during the Bismarck action when we had boiler trouble and they had to plug superheater tubes on the run. And the boiler maker who did the job I knew very well. He was little Scouser, Scouse Nesbitt. He was the smallest boiler maker on board. And he was the only one that could get in a superheater. And he was actually plugging tubes, plugging these leaking tubes, when they were chasing Bismarck.
How dangerous was that for him?
Well, very dangerous, because under all the rules and regulations, you should have at least two valves closed between you and live steam before you enter a boiler, shut and last. But the boiler had just been steaming, and it was shut down, of course, and it was shut off. And with hose pipes and wet sacking and things like that, he got in and plugged the tubes. And all he got for that was a mention in dispatches. Now, during the Bismarck action, I'm not being a spoil sport here, but Rodney fired 12 torpedoes at Bismarck with no registered hit. The torpedoes, I've got to admit, had the DSM for that. So I say the engineer is not always recognised when it comes to anything like that. But we then went back and finished up in Rosyth getting our boilers repaired again. And we came back to Gibraltar then to John Force H under Admiral Somerville. And next episode then was North African landings. We took part in the landings mainly off Oran, covering the American forces going into Oran. We did meet opposition from the French fortifications at Merzel Kebir, and we opened fire. And eventually Fort Santan surrendered to the Americans on, I think, the 10th of November.
What were your own personal memories of the torch landings?
Well, I had the catapult was my responsibility at that time. And usually the walrus was off the catapult, which is situated on X turret, during a 16-inch gunfire. Unfortunately, we were called upon to open fire when the walrus was on the catapult. Now, the walrus is used for dawn and dusk anti-submarine patrols, and she had to be off at dawn next morning. So the maintenance crew and the air crew worked all night with the aid of stick and plaster and chewing gum, I believe, to get the thing together again so she could take off next morning. She wasn't fired off the catapult, she took off the water. But we couldn't fire off the catapult until we'd after 16-inch gunfire without a light shot to test the catapult. So she was lowered over the side, which was not unusual in the Mediterranean because the sea was usually flat enough to take off the water instead of catapulting. And she took off, and eventually when she reached operational height, she just literally disintegrated. They managed to get her down alongside a hull trawler of the Derby County, who picked them up and took them back alongside, took them back on board. And we used to go ashore in Mersey Kabir during the progress up the coast. We finished up off Algiers then, which we were destined to go into on Christmas Day. Spent Christmas in Algiers. Unfortunately, Admiral Darlan had been assassinated. So they thought it unwise for a British battle squadron to go into Algiers at that time. So we spent Christmas 1943 at sea, celebrating Christmas Day. And then eventually then we went into Malta then. And we are the first battleships to enter Malta since 1940. And from...
Did you get a big reception?
Oh, yes, indeed. I'm not going to ever go any further on that, on record. Some things I can't say on record. But anyway, the next episode then was the invasion of Sicily. It was Husky, which we were operating. We were involved in the landings of Sicily, which were the only... real thing that struck us there. We weren't actively involved either in bombardment or getting into any enemy apart from air attacks, which were always with us. But one thing that sticks out in our memories is that the Americans dropped their airborne forces in the water. And they had tremendous losses then, not through enemy action, but through inefficiency. Let's say the Sicilian campaign went fairly well. We covered the landings and eventually went into Catania, which is a Italian naval base and air force base. And then we prepared then for the operation across the Straits of Messina. We operated up the Calabrian coast. Bombardments there of enemy positions. One notable occasion when we hit an ammunition dump, which went up with very spectacular results, which could be seen. But
where was this?
Off the Calabrian coast in the Straits of Messina. And then eventually, during the Italian landings, we went up then to cover Salerno and the Anzio landings, Salerno mainly. The Germans then started using glider bombs. They were radio-controlled bombs, which we escaped, but they caught Warspite. She was hit down the funnel with a glider bomb. She came back to Malta for repairs, but Warspite had... I've been involved in more actions than any other battleship in the Royal Navy. She earned 13 battle honours, Warspite. Rodney earned 11. And say after Salerno, Sicily, the Italian fleet surrendered. And the reason for Force H had then finished. And it was disbanded, and we came back then to Gibraltar and on to the UK. We did the usual Scapa routine. And then the everything was then working up for the big one, the Normandy landings. We were engaged in the Normandy landings, as you know. We sailed for the Normandy landings. And we're off the Smalls when the delay was announced, so we turned back and steamed around all night, came back and rendezvoused off the Smalls, and it was on. That was the 5th of June, and we went in then on the 6th of June with the landing forces, and we involved the convoy we were with was being shelled from ashore, so we engaged the shore batteries and put them out of action, and it was only a 5-minute action actually on D-Day. We went in the day after and stayed there until the end of July.
Did you get hit by any?
No, we weren't. We weren't hit at all. As a matter of fact, for Rodney herself, the ship itself, it was very uneventful, really, because no one opened fire on us, and we did all the aggression, as it so happened. There was danger. Nelson picked up a mine. She had a nose for mines. That was the third one she picked up, I think. Well, she had a torpedo and two mines. You know, Rodney was virtually undamaged except for that 1,000-pound bomb, apart from from wear and tear.
What are the Smalls?
The Smalls lighthouse off in the Irish Sea. And Nelson, as a matter of fact, went into Milford Haven. Waiting to be called for D-Day. She went in for shelter. She sheltered in Milford Haven while we steamed around with the convoy and then eventually headed south for Normandy. Nelson was held in reserve for D-Day.
Had you expected Normandy to be much bloodier?
Yes, we did. Because with all the hype, with all the Atlantic Wall, etc., with the Germans and built up, the guns were there. But they weren't in the places where we were. Their heavy coastal batteries were placed in different places. They were expecting the landings to take place much nearer Pas-de-Calais than in Normandy. But the small arms fire and the lighter artillery weapon fire was very intense on the beaches. They had a very bad time, the Americans especially. Of course, they choose a bad time for their sector anyway compared to ours. Our people got ashore through the sea defences. Our naval beach parties all got ashore. And the Royal Marine commanders all went in, prepared the way for the main landing forces. There were a lot of mishaps.